Accession number 29959, Reel 5.
I wasn't qualifying as a marine engineer, I was qualifying as an air engineer, which I already was.
This is Reel number 5, where Commander Constable. So we've got you out of the Middle East, you've been back to the UK,
yes.
You've been out to Trinidad.
Yes.
And where did you go next? Is there still more time or still?
No.
Just finished now.
That's when you went to Oxford.
Oh, hang on.
45, 46. 43. You've turned straight Navy then, because up to 45 you've been RMVR.
That's correct, yes.
Now, I was just going to ask were you demobilised or not, but
no
is the answer.
When he was 25 and he was at Oxford, when he was at Oxford that we went to Andover.
Hang on. Hang on.
That was before you were sent out to Trinidad.
That's right, yes. Yes.
And what were you flying? What were you
flying? Everything. I'm just looking at this Soulfish, Albacore, Walrus, Barracuda, Fulmer, Barracuda. I suppose you could say that's in 1944 it was basically the Fulmers and the Barracudas, occasional saltfish, Fulmer, Barracuda, this is all 44, Barracuda, Spitfire, Seafire, Hurricane.
And when we're talking about test pilots here, what were you actually trying to do?
It was basically, I suppose you could say, maintenance test flying. I always referred to it. It was checking the aircraft for, well, basically, quite a lot of time after it had been brought out of storage, or it had suffered some sort of accident and had been repaired. And that's where most of my work came in, was on aircraft after they'd been subject to an accident. Quite often it was an accident on board a carrier, which they'd gone and hit the barrier and clobbered themselves a bit, been shipped ashore and sort of rebuilt, and then I tested them, and I, you know, tested them for everything I had to do.
So having spent so many years looking after aircraft,
yeah,
out in the Middle East,
yeah,
back in the UK doing,
yeah,
again the maintenance thing, when you went to Trinidad it must have been heartbreaking just to smash them all up.
Well, I went to Trinidad to, as I say, to really look after and close down the place and return the ratings back to the UK. But we had to get rid of the aircraft, and there was not much of a way around it. I mean, they either had to be ditched or, as I say, melted down. Or I wanted to return the small Osters to the club, and they wouldn't allow me to do that. So we ditched them as well. We just took them on. They sent a couple of carriers in, put them on board the decks, just pushed them over the side into the sea, and that was it. But that was the orders from the UK. You see, let's face it, we had aircraft all over the world. And what were they going to do with them? They just had to dispose of them. The war was over. Well, who to? You don't sell them to the enemy, and you know, there was no one who wanted them, really, love. And the Americans didn't want them. I mean, they had their own aircraft, you see. Anyway.
So we're talking about the war finishing now, the end of the,
yeah,
war. Do you remember where you were, what you were doing on occasions like VE Day or VJ Day? Or?
Yes, you were on board an American ship. You were coming. I think you were on your way home, and you were coming up from Trinidad, as far as I can remember your story, and you had to go via Canada.
I was coming up.
Drinking a glass of milk.
I was coming up. I was taking passage on an American destroyer going into Baltimore. From Baltimore, I was going up to Canada to come home. And American ships are dry in the sense that they don't have alcohol. They do have milk. So I'm drinking milk on board this American aircraft. But the thing that I think Lillian was thinking of, I was walking on the deck with this deck officer. Have I got this right? And I think I was in New York on the day that they dropped the atom bomb on the Japanese. Now, what year was that they dropped the atom bomb? Can you remember that?
At the end of, so that was 45.
Yeah. I'd actually landed up in New York. I was there and they dropped the atom bomb, and that's when I was supposed to be going down to the Pacific Fleet, and I was diverted and I ended up in Trinidad. But after that I actually went down to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, if you remember, love, and I saw all the devastation going on. That was when I was on the American destroyer, and I was coming back from there, really, to make my way home via Newfoundland, etc. And I was talking to an American deck officer, and I was saying how dreadful it was what I'd seen. I mean, I'd seen what was basically a civilian population absolutely devastated by an atomic bomb. I probably saw the worst of everything there. I was talking to him how dreadful it was. The thing that always stuck in my mind was, I'm talking to him, he'd been born in the middle of America and he'd served in the American Navy. And he just said to me, "Oh, well, they were Japs." No, just like that. They were Japs. So it didn't matter, did it? And I thought this was absolutely dreadful. But there we are, you know. I don't think he'd seen any action at all, but that was one of those things that always stuck in my mind. Didn't matter.
Did you find when you were talking to people who have been in combat, they had a bit more respect for the other side?
Absolutely. Absolutely I did. And I've spoken, Lillian knows, we've met Germans who were on the other side in Rommel's army, and we had quite a lot of respect for each other because we were the same sort of people, basically. And it was all politics, really. That was all. Anyway, you know, that was it.
So yeah. We've got you to the end of the war now. This is 1945.
Yep.
But you weren't demobbed and you didn't leave the forces.
No, I elected to stay in, didn't I, love? Because what was I coming out to? I looked at the area I was coming out. I was coming out to unemployment. What the hell? And
what happened was, when you came back from Trinidad, was that when you went up to Cullum for 3 months?
Yes, that's right, love. Yeah.
In Oxford.
Yeah, yeah.
Then from there you went to the box at Leon Solon.
Yes, I was in the box at Leon Solon. That was the box. It was the brain box at Leon Solon, and I became a planner there, didn't I?
You were there for about 2.5 years.
Yes, that's
so
right.
What were you planning?
Basically, I was in charge of the deployment of maintenance ratings in the Navy, in the Fleet Air Arm, basically, and that was my big job. And we were a nice little team there. I planned what's basically squadrons would do and what their tasks were, and I had another man with me, and we planned the manning in numbers of the different style of rating and the numbers of ratings that each squadron should have.
And what they used to do there's a certain amount of exercise maintenance on planes.
That's right, yeah.
How long it should take.
Yes, that's right.
Plan maintenance.
Yes, plan. I devised what was called plan maintenance. And as Lillian says, what should be done on the planes at certain times. And
after so many hours, sorry, yeah. Certain checks, sorry.
I was just going to ask,
what rank
were you at this stage?
I was a sub-lieutenant, wasn't I?
No.
Oh.
You were two and a half.
Two and a half.
You got to 20.
That's right.
And then when you stayed in, you had to drop half a rank.
Oh, yes, that was...
You picked it up again when you were about 20.
That was annoying. I'd become a two and a half, acting two and a half. I remember coming back and that very nice rear admiral, can't think of his name at the moment, said, I'm sorry... Sutton?
Furs?
No, not Furs. He was Pratt. He said, I'm sorry, Joe. He said, you'll have to drop half a rank and become a lieutenant again. I said, oh, God. And so I dropped half a rank and became a lieutenant and served as planned flying, planned maintenance in at Leon Solent.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you there for?
I suppose I did 2 years there, didn't I?
2 years.
Just 2 years.
Just trying to think, where did we go from Lee?
That's when we went to Australia, didn't we?
No.
Yep, hang on. Commander Flying Pilly.
Yes, I think you did, because there was the cold roast bit. You went down to Cornwall to cold roast.
I went temporarily.
You turned over to the Australian Navy.
That's right. And
on loan.
On loan.
Australian Navy.
Yep. Hang on.
And you went out there for...
God.
Who loaned you out? Was it something you had any decision in?
Oh, I had to make... It came up that... They wanted officers to volunteer to serve in the Australian Navy, and it was old Cobb was the captain, wasn't he? And he put me forward for it.
Also, we talked about it, and we found it would be financially to our benefit.
That's right.
As well as seeing the world.
So this was still 45 or 46?
Well, I spent...
47 or 8.
No. 45 I was at Macrahanish.
Yes.
I then went to Piarco.
Yes.
And then from there, oh dear, they sent me to do this. Oh, we went to Cullum, love,
yep.
In 46, and we had 7 years at Cullum.
Not 7 years.
Well, I went to Cullum in March 46, and we left Cullum in November 46.
Well, that wasn't 7 years. Months.
Oh, months. Sorry, I beg your pardon. Not 7 years. seven months, yeah.
7 months.
And then I was sent to the Ajax to do my watchkeeping time.
You went to the Med.
To qualify.
9 months there.
To qualify as a marine engineer. And I that really got me, because... I went on, I should never forget this, I was serving on the Ajax, and remember I'd been to Trinidad where I had something like 250 ratings, and I'd been in Macrahanish where I had about 250 ratings, and I was a senior engineer, and I used to, when we had parades, I'd report the whole 250 to the captain. I went to the Ajax, and the commander E there, who, as I say, thought that aviators only spotted for ships, you see, and he said to me, go down, it was a Sunday, go down and Lieutenant Brown will show you how to take divisions. Well, I went, there were 9 men in Lieutenant Brown's division, and that really got up my nose. And I have to say this, the Strait Navy, who'd never been outside the Strait Navy, never appreciated the Fleet Air Arm, ever. They just couldn't get their heads around it. But there we are. From there I went to Yeovilton for a short period. And then from Yeovilton...
Argos.
No. I then went from there into the Royal Australian Navy.
Well, that was the beginning of it, going to Cornwall where the ship came in, and you did the work up down there, and a carrier came in.
Yeah. Yes, I became the AAO number 21 carrier air group with HMAS Sydney. That's correct.
And you went off Great Funnel, and I went off
the 21st carrier air group. And we went off, and you came out separately, and we joined up in Australia. I was then the area of the Sydney Carrier Air Group.
What had they loaned you out for? Was there something specific they wanted you for?
Yes, it was actually to be the bring, I suppose you say, air engineering experience to squadrons that were newly formed in the Australian Navy. And
you went out to the Glory first of all to find out.
I went out. The Glory was serving out there, and I was sent to go on board the Glory to see how they were tackling that war out there. And then I went back and joined the Sydney Carrier Air Group, which was forming, and we formed up, and we took
the Korean War,
on HMAS Sydney, you see. Mm-hmm. And I was the air engineer officer. I eventually finally inherited it as the air group commander. I took over from Mike Fell right at the very end, but up until then I was the aero, and I was controlling the aircraft that went into attack and came back mostly damaged and repaired and into the attack again. Mm-hmm. And dear old Ron Lumberg was one of the air group, one of the squadron commanders there.
Johnny
Appleby was in flying the fighter aircraft. Yeah. Yeah.
Richardson.
That's right. One or two people were killed. And
were you flying combat missions yourself?
No, I didn't fly directly combat missions. I did fly.
I think you did one or two sorties.
I did one or two sorties.
Basically, they didn't want you flying. They wanted
to. No, actually, rather interesting. I was all set to fly off on a Sea Fury. I'd actually got into the aircraft, and the captain spotted the fact that I was going to fly off, and he immediately stopped it and sent for me. I went up on the bridge, and he tore me off a strip. He said, "You're wanted here, not out there," and that stopped me from flying in combat, you see. And I suppose it was fair enough. I was running the whole of the maintenance system. I used to be up at 5 in the morning on deck, and I never went below for sleep until midnight. I was on, it was the whole thing. I had a lovely assistant, Willie Went. Dear old Willie, he was a lieutenant, and he ran the maintenance office, and he was there from 5 in the morning to midnight, and we did it that way. And we devised methods, because we had a hell of a lot of, I suppose you call it, minor damage in a way. It was damage from rifle fire, which had to be repaired. And we devised a lot of immediate patching. We saw the pattern of the damage to the aircraft, and we used to put these patches on deck. We didn't strike the aircraft down below, and we sort of riveted them with hollow rivets on the deck, and which meant the aircraft weren't struck down for damage. You know, it worked like that. It was rather good, actually. It was quite enjoyable in a way. Anyway, that was that. That was the Sydney.
Can I just ask you about the two conflicts?
Yes.
Obviously, the Second World War and the Korean War.
Yeah.
Whether there were any similarities in what you were having to do, or were they vastly different?
Well, my experience in the Second World War, it was much more heavy stuff. In the Korean War, it was we did strike bombing of basically bridges and railways and that type of thing, bridges over waterways and railway lines. Whereas in World War II, of course, we were mostly against other armed forces more. There were armed forces in Korea, but not the same heavy resistance that we had in World War II. World War II was much, much heavier stuff, you see. And that, I suppose you could say, was the major difference between those two wars.
And the types of maintenance that you were dealing with?
Well, the types of maintenance in World War II, we were dealing with swordfish and albacores, which took quite a lot of battering. Fulmers, they were pretty rough, tough aircraft. And
had you got jets on the
Sydney? No jets when I was there, love. No. I had jets later on.
Later.
Yes. And
that
Lossiemouth. I was flying. Yeah, I got the flying jets.
Mm. And there's nothing specific with the different weather conditions or the different.
What in North Africa?
Between North Africa and Korea.
And Korea.
Mm. It's very cold in Korea.
Korea was cold. We were operating at a lot of the time at -14, and it was rather odd because I realised what was happening. I had been on board the Glory and seen what they were doing, and so I organised a lot of antifreeze liquid to be on board, and the people in Melbourne, the logistics people, couldn't understand why I wanted all this antifreeze. And what I'd seen, I realised, was you actually had to spray the undercarriages of the aircraft before they took off, because they were operating in such freezing conditions and they would have problems with their undercarriages. So we developed this system that when they were on deck, they were actually sprayed with antifreeze, and I managed to get a lot of this on board to do this, and much to the chagrin of the people in Melbourne, who didn't think we needed all that antifreeze. But it was very, very cold operating.
Did it affect the oil at all in the engines?
Nothing to do with the engines.
No, not that particular bit, but the coldness generally.
Oh, no. No, once you started your engine, you had very hot.
Yes, you're creating
hot
your engine.
Oh, yeah.
Was it difficult to start them? Because sometimes.
No.
No,
we had no difficulty engine starting. We started with a cartridge starter, you see, love, which turned the engine over immediately. Sometimes you had to do it twice to turn it over properly, but that was all. Yeah, yeah.
So it was the cold, basically. Which is again, this is the surprise.
It was cold, yes, it was very cold.
The issue was special clothing to wear, including string vests and string pants, and he's never been out of them since.
I've got them on even now. Not the same ones, I isn't that. I went. Yep, I have to admit, we went into string underwear, and
string underwear works like a thermal.
Absolutely, it keeps a sort of layer of air.
And that was issued by the Australian Navy, or
oh yes, it was issued. It was issued by the Australian Navy. No, because the Brits had it on the Glory as well. No, it was realised that was the way to go. So we all wore string vests and string pants. Mm-hmm. And it works.
Not socks, though? Any special socks?
No, they never went into string socks, but, woolen socks, yes. Yeah. And
so did you notice any sort of major developments between the end of the Second World War and the Korean conflict? I'm just thinking of small things really, like possible uniform changes or possible changes, you said, with aircraft maintenance, or even little things about how men were looked after or how they were treated.
I suppose we learned a lot in World War II of how to look after people, and I thought that there was a much better rapport between the officers and the men in Korea than there was in World War II.
Mm.
But I mean, that was my personal impression. Not so much in Africa, but I would have said the attitude in Europe, basically, although there were some very good instances. I always think of Brian Horrocks, you know, General Brian Horrocks, and I always remember he was in Africa with us, and when Alamein occurred, you know, we were driven back to Alamein. And I always remember the breakout from Alamein was led by Brian Horrocks, and he was a brigadier general. Most of the generals I'd seen up until him and what's the man's
name?
Montgomery, was that most of the generals who came out prior to those two hived themselves off down into Cairo, but they didn't. And I always remember seeing Brian Horrocks go out in the leading tank when we broke out from Alamein, which always impressed me. And I had a great pleasure. He came and lectured us when I was on the staff college here in England after the war. And he came and lectured, and I was able...
In
53. And I was able to meet with him at lunchtime and talk to him about this. And he was, you know, delighted that somebody had seen this and seen him do it, which was interesting, I thought. But and Montgomery, I always remember seeing Montgomery arrive with his squeaky voice, and I thought, oh my God, another damned general, because we'd had so many out there. But I had to take my words back, because he turned out to be absolutely first class, did Montgomery. He didn't leave the desert, whereas all the others, as I say, went off to Cairo. And Montgomery and Horrocks, I have a lot of admiration for those two.
The name of the village was Benson.
What, sorry?
Benson. The name of the village was Benson, that he lived in.
Oh, Benson. That's right, in England. That's right. He used to go and collect his old age pension. It was Montgomery.
Sorry, we were trying to think of it the other night. I couldn't remember.
Yeah, Benson, you've got it. You've got it. Anyway, there we are.
I was trying to think of something else, actually, because you were obviously still dealing with conscripts, weren't you, in the Korean War? You did a national servicemen. Did you come across them a lot, or were you mostly dealing with regulars?
Well, most of them were. They were national service, yes, conscripts, I suppose. Whenever we came across what I called pure RN, they were small in numbers compared with the number of people who were XR or RMVR, it was the RMVR basically that flooded everything, and conscripts, of course, but because the straight Navy people were few and far between, certainly with us in North Africa, so that was quite significant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these were people who had taken out of civilian life and trained and thrown into it, you see. Yeah.
Did you find the national servicemen had adequate training for what they were expected to do?
I would have said yes. Yeah, I've never any criticism of the training we received. And I looked up to the people who were training us. They were very good.
And did you find the national servicemen were very different to deal with?
Oh yes, they were. The straight Navy people, as I say, not a lot of them I come across who were permanent straight Navy. A few of them were. Some of them were first class, but most of them were what I called volunteer reserves or conscripts, and they were much more inclined to criticise what was going on, whereas the Straight Navy people didn't criticise so much. I'm just trying to think, there was a, it was a member of the royal family who came out to our